Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
On Valentine's Day 2004, one of Italy's greatest cyclists was found dead in mysterious circumstances.
There's growing mystery about the death of one of the country's sporting heroes, Marco Pantani.
In November 2021, new evidence had come to light, alleging that the Italian mafia were involved in Marco Pantani's death.
The mafia goes where money is.
It's a very dark story, the Pantani story.
Sport's strangest crimes. Marco Pantani, Death of a Pirate.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 10th of June, these are our main stories. Full details of the criminal charges against Donald Trump have been revealed by US federal prosecutors. The former Prime Minister of Britain, Boris Johnson, resigns as an MP, saying he's been driven out of Parliament by what he calls a witch hunt. An Australian newspaper apologises for its racist coverage of a massacre of Aboriginal women and children 2 centuries ago. Also in this podcast, fans prepare to enjoy the 100th anniversary of the great endurance car race, Le Mans.
It's pretty unique and special. Ultimate test of man and machine, or woman and machine, and 24 hours racing on the limits. Very much an endurance-focused event.
US federal prosecutors have revealed the full details of the criminal charges against Donald Trump for allegedly retaining classified government documents after he left the White House. Mr. Trump faces more than 30 charges, most of them for the willful retention of government documents, some containing nuclear secrets. Other charges include obstruction and making false statements. The U.S. special counsel is Jack Smith.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with felony violations of our national security laws, as well as participating in a conspiracy to obstruct justice. This indictment was voted by a grand jury of citizens in the Southern District of Florida. The men and women of the United States intelligence community and our armed forces dedicate their lives to protecting our nation and its people. Our laws that protect national defense information are critical to the safety and security of the United States, and they must be enforced. Violations of those laws put our country at risk. We have one set of laws in this country, and they apply to everyone.
Mr. Trump himself first announced he'd been charged on Thursday, insisting he was innocent. Since then, two of his lawyers have resigned. Our correspondent in Washington, Gary O'Donoghue, told us more about the charges against Mr. Trump.
Well, they're pretty serious ones, Jeanette, to be honest. I mean, 31 of them relate to specific documents that saying he shouldn't have held on to, relating to national security. And as you said, some of them relate to America's nuclear weapons. Some of them relate to retaliation plans if there was a military attack. And some of them were designed, you know, to be only seen by a very few people, including some of America's allies. And they were kept in the most extraordinary way, scattered between this ballroom, this storage room, this shower room with a chandelier in it, would you believe? One of those kinds of shower rooms. And they found these documents in various ways. Now, the potential dangers for Donald Trump here, if he's convicted, are prison terms, long prison terms potentially. You can get anything from 10, you know, up to 10 years for charges under the Espionage Act, and obstruction of justice, which he's also charged with, can be longer.
So given that, what should we make of the fact that two of his long-standing lawyers resigned just hours before this indictment was unsealed?
Well, Donald Trump has a huge churn in lawyers all the time, been through an awful lot of them, and I imagine there were differences of opinion, and that tends to be what happens with them. So he's going to have to look for some more lawyers to take on this particular case. And, of course, it's not the only case, is it? There's another criminal indictment he's facing in New York, brought by the state of New York, there, or the district attorney in Manhattan, to do with those hush money payments to the porn star Stormy Daniels. There he's facing financial charges, business regulation charges. Again, some of them felonies like these he's facing in Florida. So the legal problems keep on mounting, and that's before we've even got to whether or not there'll be charges brought in Georgia over attempts to overturn the election result there.
And briefly, what does this mean for his hopes of winning the White House again?
Well, he'll raise a bunch of money off the back of this. He did when the last set of criminal charges were brought down. He's selling T-shirts for $40-odd off the back of these group of charges. But, of course, you know, these trials, when they happen, will be right in the middle of the Republican primary. So how much time is he going to have to devote to this as opposed to actually campaigning to get the nomination?
Gary O'Donoghue. On the other side of the Atlantic, a man often compared to Donald Trump, the former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, has dropped his own political bombshell. He's announced he's standing down as a Member of Parliament with immediate effect, using language often associated with Mr. Trump. In an unusually strong resignation statement, Mr. Johnson lashed out at the government, claiming he was the victim of a Brexit witch hunt. He described a parliamentary investigation into his conduct during the COVID pandemic as a kangaroo court trying to drive him out of politics. Joanne Nadler, a Conservative Party adviser, says Mr. Johnson's resignation will cause problems for her party.
He delivered Brexit. Yes, he did. But he left a lot of it undone and has passed that on to his two successors. And I think at this stage, to stand down in this way, it seems to me to be something of an abrogation of responsibility to his party. And it would obviously have enemies of the Conservative Party cheering to the rafters.
I asked our political correspondent, Rob Watson, if Mr. Johnson had jumped before he was pushed.
I think very much so. And I think this is classic Boris Johnson. I think this was carefully thought out. And it is attack as the best form of defence. There was no doubt, it seems to me, that the committee was going to find that he had misled Parliament and was going to recommend some form of a suspension, which might have led to a by-election. And so what Boris Johnson has decided to go is full out attack, but not just on the committee, but also on his colleagues in the governing Conservative Party. And broader than that, as you say, utterly redolent of Donald Trump. I mean, eerily redolent of Donald Trump. This idea, first time I've ever heard it from a former British Prime Minister, of a conspiracy theory. This idea that there's a plot to get Boris Johnson as the leader of Brexit and ultimately to reverse it.
So what does all this mean for the government of the current Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak?
I think it's an utter and total nightmare on so many fronts, because on the first hand, you've got the potential for civil war in the governing Conservative Party, where it splits into a wing that's pro-Boris Johnson, another wing that's pro-Rishi Sunak. So that's problem number one. I mean, problem number two is just that the British voters are going to say, hang on a minute, the Conservative Party, it's just one episode of chaos after another. And given that there is a cost of living crisis in this country, and given how badly the Conservatives are doing in the opinion polls, and given that an election isn't that far away, I mean, you just couldn't imagine anything much worse for Mr. Sunak.
And is this the end of Boris Johnson's career? He did hint that he might be trying to come back. And if so, what's his legacy?
So let's deal with his legacy first. That will always be Brexit, that Britain would not have left the European Union without Boris Johnson's leadership. To get to the nub of the first question, I think Mr. Johnson doesn't see this as the end of his political career. That's why he says, I'm leaving Parliament for now. I think he sees himself very much in the statement, again referring to Donald Trump, as this idea that he's there, ready and waiting, you know, to re-lead the Conservative Party, to re-lead Britain, sort of post-Brexit Britain. But I think the problem that he faces is that the British public has moved on. And if you ask opinion pollsters who do these research groups, and they say, give us one word that you associate with Boris Johnson, and the word that comes up above all others is liar.
Rob Watson. The European Union's foreign policy chief says the dam in southern Ukraine, which collapsed on Tuesday, was destroyed with explosives planted in its turbine chamber. The dam was in an area under Russian control. Josep Borrell said everything pointed to Moscow being behind the demolition, which had caused catastrophic flooding. With more details, here's our correspondent in Kyiv, Paul Adams.
Speaking in Madrid, the EU's foreign policy chief said explosives had been planted inside the adjacent turbine chamber, an area under Russian control. That explosion, he said, could not have been caused by anyone else. Ukraine's domestic intelligence, meanwhile, has released a recording of what it says is a phone conversation between two unnamed Russian military men discussing how Russia was responsible for blowing up the dam. In the recording, which the BBC cannot verify, one says a Russian sabotage group was responsible, but that the explosion went much further than planned. A wealth of evidence now points to Russia's responsibility for this catastrophic act. It seems the destruction of the dam and the subsequent flooding were designed to deny Ukraine one possible avenue of attack as its counteroffensive gets underway. The latest reports from the front lines south of Zaporizhia suggest that it's now gathering pace.
Paul Adams. When Russian soldiers invaded Ukraine last year, they were told it would be over within days. Now, 16 months on, some of them have lost faith in Moscow and its so-called special military operation. Of those that flee, few speak out publicly. Now, a Russian Air Force lieutenant, Dmitry Mishov, has told the BBC why he decided to seek asylum abroad.
In the military, no one believes the authorities. They can see what is really happening. There are not some civilians in front of the telly. The military do not believe official reports because they are simply not true.
The BBC's Russian service editor, Andrei Goryanov, told us more about his story.
Dmitry Mishov, a 26-year-old Russian military helicopter navigator, fled Russia to avoid fighting in Ukraine. He eventually made it to Lithuania, where he's seeking asylum. He told the BBC it was his duty to protect his country from aggression, but not to become an accomplice in a crime. And his case is quite significant because it is rare for a Russian pilot to defect or at least to go public about it. I think it's maybe the first case since the beginning of the war when a pilot does that. Dmitry tells us about the losses in the Russian military. They're quite high, particularly among the highly skilled military personnel, and many amongst the military start to realize what's actually happening. They're not civilians in front of the telly. They really know what is happening on the ground, he tells us.
He's indicating that he thinks a lot of his colleagues share his sentiments.
He thinks that a lot of the colleagues start to realize what is happening, but they have a false sense of patriotism, or they're thinking about their oath to Russian military. But some of them are talking to him about whether they could do the same. And they start to think that the war is going in a very wrong direction and they don't want to lose their lives in the war, which is a crime, according to Dmitry Mishov.
As you say, this is just one man, a rare defection of a pilot. What's your understanding of the situation in the Russian military as far as you're able to understand it, given the fog of war?
He paints quite a gloomy picture of Russian military. He says that in the beginning of the war, the Russian Air Force were unprepared for war and aircraft were lacking basic maintenance. He also claims that there is extensive corruption within military, many helicopter pilots repeatedly targeting the same locations in return for Ministry of Defense compensation for destroyed targets. And many of that is because of the bad communication within the Russian commanders, or the lack of intelligence, or they don't care about people.
And is that something you've been able to verify independently or through other sources?
His statements haven't been independently verified, but much of it tallies with the BBC's own sources. If you look deeper into what kind of military men were being killed, it's really the very high-skilled military professionals. That kind of information is more or less the same what Dmitry Mishov tells us.
Andrei Goryanov. As we heard in the earlier podcast, hundreds of children caught in the crossfire in the war in Sudan have been rescued in a daring and dangerous evacuation as fighting in the country continues. Nearly 300 children and babies were successfully taken from the Maya Goma orphanage in the capital Khartoum to Wad Madani in the south of Sudan. Sarah Moneta reports from Nairobi.
The moment the Red Cross convoy was given the go-ahead and set off on its perilous journey, taking hundreds of orphans away from the fighting. Blue buses advancing on a bumpy, dusty road, crossing checkpoints with the roar of the clashes in the distance. This is Osman Abu Fatima, UNICEF's child protection expert on the ground.
Among the children evacuated, there is around 44 children suffer from severe malnutrition, 23 children they have health complications. 8 out of them are in critical conditions.
After a difficult 4-hour drive, the relief of finally having reached safety. The city of Wad Madani, about 200 kilometres south of Khartoum. 297 children were taken here, about 200 of them below the age of 2. Some were taken to hospital for treatment as soon as they stepped off the bus. The children's ordeal started when the war between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces broke out in mid-April. The Maya Goma orphanage was caught up in the crossfire, 400 children trapped near the front line. The area where the cradles were kept was damaged after a bomb hit a nearby building. Power and water were cut, and most of the staff was unable to reach the orphanage. 67 children died in the past few weeks due to malnutrition and heat. A group of older kids between the ages of 4 and 15 was evacuated last weekend by local activists. 4 white and blue minibuses made their way to the town of Hala Saisa with a blanket hung at the front of the convoy. On it, a handwritten message to the militias. There are kids on board. Hiba Abdullah is one of the orphanage carers who travelled with them.
We took a risk to bring these kids to conditions that are not as risky as the circumstances they were in. We extracted them from certain death to a fate that I hope is better.
Back in Wad Madani, the hope now is that the orphans will find families to take them in.
So the most important thing for these children is that we get them into safe and loving family care.
This is Marie-Louise Eagleton, UNICEF's deputy representative in Sudan.
There are lists of foster families who have been prepared, who've been trained, who stand ready to take these children. And that's what's so extraordinary, is that it's really about communities coming together.
UNICEF's Marie-Louise Eagleton ending that report by Sarah Moneta. Still to come,
archaeologists were astonished when they came across what remained of one unfortunate Roman soldier.
We'll tell you why after this break.
On Valentine's Day 2004, one of Italy's greatest cyclists was found dead in mysterious circumstances.
There's growing mystery about the death of one of the country's sporting heroes, Marco Pantani.
In November 2021, new evidence had come to light, alleging that the Italian mafia were involved in Marco Pantani's death.
The mafia goes where money is.
It's a very dark story, the Pantani story.
Sport's strangest crimes. Marco Pantani, death of a pirate.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service that goes beyond the spin, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news. An honest explanation of the events shaping our lives. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The World Food Programme says it's suspending some food aid to Ethiopia while it addresses worries that donations are being diverted from those in need. The country's biggest donor, the United States, announced a similar move on Thursday. Simon Ponsford reports.
Drought and war have left more than 20 million people in Ethiopia short of food and relying heavily on the United Nations and the United States for help. Now both have put a temporary halt to aid while they investigate allegations that food is being diverted. Assistance to the most vulnerable, such as children and new mothers, will continue. The Ethiopian government says it's committed to finding out what's going on. Reports to donors have suggested that government entities are orchestrating widespread diversion of food and that Ethiopian military units are benefiting.
Simon Ponsford. Here in Britain, the Guardian newspaper recently apologised for its founders' links to transatlantic slavery. Now the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia has apologised for its coverage of a massacre of Aboriginal people two centuries ago. The massacre of 28 people, most of them women and children, in the New South Wales town of Myall Creek was the first and only time white Australians were prosecuted for the mass killing of the country's first inhabitants. Sue Blacklock is a descendant of one of the boys who escaped the massacre. She features in a video published by the Sydney Morning Herald as part of their apology.
I was told that all of a sudden there was horses coming. Just ran over their fire and started shooting and using their bayonets on the kids and killing all the women. One little girl ran into a shack that one of the men lived in, and the others, what they didn't kill, they just tied them by the neck, rope around their neck, and let them and put them in the stockyards.
In a stark statement, the Herald admitted the reason it had campaigned for the killers was not because of any doubt about their guilt, but simply because they were white and the dead were black. Michael Bristow told us more about the massacre.
It happened in 1838 in a remote part of New South Wales. There'd been a lot of killing of Aboriginal people before and after this. This is just one of a series of incidents. In this one, a group of 11 farmers, some of them convicts, some of them free settlers, they gathered together a group of Aboriginal people, women, children, men, tied them up, took them out to a lonely spot and killed them, and then tried to burn the bodies in order to cover up the evidence. At the time, they were arrested and prosecuted, and the Sydney Morning Herald campaigned to have, first of all, these men not put on trial in the first place, and then when they were convicted, it campaigned to try and stop them being executed.
Herald is now saying that it did this simply because the perpetrators were white, not because it had any doubts about their guilt.
Yes, I mean, in fact, I'll read out a bit of the editorial there. It says, "This was not due to lack of evidence or genuine doubts about the integrity of any legal process, but because the perpetrators were white and the dead black." It's quite a stark editorial, really. A little bit late, 185 years after the fact, but still the newspaper is coming out. It's explaining that it did something that was wrong. What it says, essentially, is that although attitudes were different at that time, and many Europeans who colonised or went and settled in Australia, many Europeans were in favour of the killing and the disbursement of Aboriginal people. But still, the newspaper said, even at the time, it was an outlier. It went beyond what was expected at the time. It even, in one editorial, called Aboriginal people savages and called for people to kill them.
As you say, this was 185 years ago. So why this apology now?
Well, I think there's a movement in Australia to finally try and reappraise the past, to atone for the past. Later on this year, the Labour government in Australia is going to bring a referendum forward, which it hopes will lead to the constitution being changed so that Aboriginal voices will be enshrined in the government of Australia, and any issue that relates to First Nations people is related to these committee, which they hope will be set up. And so lots of other institutions and organisations are just looking at themselves and reappraising the past, which was a horrific time for Aboriginal people.
Michael Bristow speaking there. This weekend will be the 100-year anniversary of the 24-hour Le Mans race, described as the biggest and best endurance event in motorsport. Hundreds of thousands of racing fans have descended on the French city to watch a spectacle which is a test of skill, courage and mechanical innovation. Our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick, considers the appeal of an event with a huge global following.
Once again, it's the start of the most exciting 24 hours in the sports car world, the great international tussle at Le Mans.
On a circuit of public roads and dedicated track, cars at full throttle, the fastest covering distances nowadays of some 5,000 kilometres. The prize victory in what is described as the toughest test on four wheels. Over a day and a night, average speeds exceed 200 kilometres per hour on a course of hills and corners, not to mention the time it takes to stop and refuel. It's a spectacle that draws huge crowds to the French city. A record attendance of more than 300,000 is expected over the weekend, many of the fans camping in tents, ready to savour the party atmosphere. And for the drivers who take part, it presents a demanding proposition. Australia's Mark Webber, who also competed in Formula One, describes its attraction and its challenges.
It's pretty unique and special. Ultimate test of man and machine, or woman and machine, and 24 hours racing on the limit. Very much an endurance-focused event. You race at night. For a driver to shut down in the race, it's not easy. So when I competed in, I didn't really have much success at having too much sleep. Often some drivers will definitely be awake for 30 hours straight, 32 hours straight, which is quite extraordinary.
And the Mercedes hurled itself like a thunderbolt into an enclosure packed with spectators.
But for all the reasons to be captivated, it's also an event which produced the deadliest crash in motorsport history. During the 1955 race, a Mercedes driven by Pierre Levege collided with an embankment and flew over the barriers into the crowd before bursting into flames. 103 people were killed, a further 180 were injured in the tragedy. As a result, safety standards were improved. This weekend, though, is a celebration of a race that pushes drivers, their teams and machinery to the edge, of a fierce competition between automotive giants to be the best, a demonstration of their engineering prowess. Recently, Toyota has dominated, but legendary brands including Porsche and Ferrari will also line up in the centenary. There have been challenges along the way, but its popularity seems undimmed. Who's to say the Le Mans 24-hour race won't be around for another 100 years?
That report by Alex Capstick. What's thought to be the oldest remaining intact piece of Roman upper body armour is due to go on display in Germany, near where it was discovered in Kalkriese, in the northwest of the country. The cuirass, which is a protective metal cover for the upper body, is believed to have been worn by a Roman soldier 2,000 years ago at the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest, in which German tribes routed the Roman invaders. More from our Berlin correspondent, Jenny Hill.
For all its reach and ambition, the Roman Empire struggled to subdue what is now northwest Germany. Its soldiers met violent resistance, and in the year 9 AD, in what's still seen as a spectacular military feat, Germanic tribes wiped out the invading army. 2,000 years later, archaeologists were astonished when they came across what remained of one unfortunate Roman soldier. His upper body armour, made from metal plates joined together to cover the chest, back and shoulders, is the oldest surviving piece of its kind. Historians are still mystified as to why it remained on the battlefield when most other valuable items were plundered by the triumphant fighters. A metal yoke found near the neckline suggests the soldier was likely shackled and possibly even killed in a victory ritual. The armour has now been fully restored and will go on public display at a museum close to where the soldier fell. His protective equipment considered cutting edge at the time, not enough to save him or his army.
Jenny Hill. And that's all from us for now, but before we go, the Happy Pod is back. Here's Jackie Leonard.
Thank you. Yes, the Happy Pod will be out later on Saturday, June the 10th, with more on that extraordinary rescue of hundreds of children from an orphanage in Khartoum. We'll hear about how Finland is powering ahead with green energy production, revolutionary brain implants helping a paralysed man walk, what makes a truly great children's book, and the satisfying throaty roar of a motorbike in Lithuania. All that and more in the Happy Pod. Go on, it'll cheer you up.
And if you want to comment on this Global News podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Clara Graham.
And I'm the BBC World Affairs editor, John Simpson.
And we'd like to tell you about a new podcast from the BBC World Service The Explanation.
The Explanation looks beyond the headlines, bringing you in-depth analysis of the stories affecting our lives.
Whether it's important, long-running issues,
or the latest global events,
we're making sense of the big stories
and giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
On Valentine's Day 2004, one of Italy's greatest cyclists was found dead in mysterious circumstances.
There's growing mystery about the death of one of the country's sporting heroes, Marco Pantani.
In November 2021, new evidence had come to light, alleging that the Italian mafia were involved in Marco Pantani's death.
The mafia goes where money is.
It's a very dark story, the Pantani story.
Sport's strangest crimes. Marco Pantani, Death of a Pirate.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.